Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 591, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on April 1st of the year 2007. In Side 1, we left off talking about types of engineered rice that turned out to have some illicitly inserted genes in them, and those mistakes, if they were mistakes, have cost American rice farmers a great deal. The genes came in courtesy of two types of altered rice. One was from Bayer, and the other was from BASF, both of them former member companies of IG Farben. In a number of broadcasts, in For the Record Program 385, A Formula for Disaster, and other programs since, most recently For the Record 552, in which I revisited the formula, I've talked about the utilization of the Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process developed by IG Farben and used to develop much of its aviation gasoline and other fuel during World War II, and the probability that with the rising price of oil and with my hypothesizing that in fact the book The Formula was based on fact, and that a catalyst would emerge that would make the Fischer-Tropsch process much more efficient and therefore competitive with naturally produced oil, well, in fact, just such a thing has happened. In the book The Formula, the Adam Stiefel character played in the major motion picture made out of that book by Marlon Brando, Adam Stiefel says to the police detective played by George C. Scott in the movie, "Don't worry, America will manufacture synthetic fuel and in vast quantities, but when the profit margin could be assured." And I took a fair amount of BS for doing For the Record 385. A lot of people said, oh, it's a novel, you know, you'll lose credibility. Well, shucks. Now the Fischer-Tropsch process is indeed coming into play. Now that the price of oil has been driven high by a variety of things, including and especially war, and surprise, surprise, we now have a catalyst, as discussed in For the Record 552, that will make the Fischer-Tropsch process competitive. Well, Adam Stiefel said America will begin manufacturing synthetic fuel and in large quantities when it could be proved profitable. Well, the following, this comes from New York Stock Exchange Wire News, and I will have the references in the written description for the program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. The first article, America's First Coal-to-Liquid Energy Plants. The formula come to reality. America is indeed beginning to manufacture synthetic fuel using the Fischer-Tropsch process. The $1 billion Bull Mountain plant is slated to produce 22,000 barrels a day per day of diesel fuel and 300 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 240,000 homes in 6 years. Schweitzer and the companies behind the plant, including Arch Coal and DKRW Advanced Fuels LLC, say the production of fuel and electricity will not release the greenhouse gases with coal-generated electricity. And that is the essence of an article that is available on the Yahoo website. Specifically, the article is Liquid Coal, A Cheaper, Cleaner 21st Century Fuel by Steve James, that from Sunday, December 17th of the year 2006. And I'll have, it's a Reuters story, Dateline New York, and I'll have the Yahoo link. I'm not sure that's still active, but I'll have it on in the description for the Spitfire website. That was the meat of the article there. The article begins and continues, "When railroads ruled, it was the sweating firemen shoveling coal into the furnace who kept the engines running. Now, nearly two centuries after Stevenson's rocket steam locomotive helped usher in the Industrial Revolution, that same coal could be the fuel that keeps the jet age aloft. But with a twist, the planes of the future could be flown with liquid fuel made from coal or natural gas. Already, the United States Air Force has carried out tests flying a B-52 Stratofortress with a coal-based fuel. And JetBlue Airways supports a bill in Congress that would extend tax credits for alternative fuels, pushing technology to produce jet fuel for the equivalent of $40 a barrel, way below current oil prices. Major coal mining companies in the United States, which has more coal reserves than Saudi Arabia has oil, are investing in ways to develop fuels derived from carbon. The technology of producing a liquid fuel from coal or natural gas is hardly new. The Fischer-Tropsch process was developed by German researchers Franz Fischer and Hans Tropsch in 1923 and used by Germany and Japan during World War II to produce alternative fuels. Indeed, in 1944, Germany produced 6.5 million tons, or 124,000 barrels a day. And coal-to-liquid CTL fuel is already in use elsewhere, like South Africa, where it meets 30% of transportation fuel needs. In addition to being cheaper than oil, advocates point out that the fuel is environmentally friendlier and would also help America wean itself of foreign oil imports. And do note that the same companies will be profiting from that. One of the things that one wants to become aware of are the profound cartel connections between IG Farben and Standard Oil. A number of different broadcasts, including For the Record 506, go into some of those. For the Record 511 is another of the programs that covers those. And, of course, books like Treason's Peace, The Devil's Chemists, All Honorable Men, and Germany's Master Plan, available on the Spitfire website, go into that for a post-war IG Farben update, so to speak. Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. So, again, the legacy of IG Farben is very much with us today. In connection with also the concept of the realization of the formula, the resuscitation of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929 and the Fischer-Tropsch process, AVEC Catalyst, remember that one of the things that is serving as the intellectual foundation for permanently high oil prices is the concept of peak oil. I always have to preface this. I am anti-fossil fuels. If two thumbs down for me on fossil fuels. If I were an octopus, it would be eight thumbs down. But the peak, there are very firm indications that peak oil is not only a monopolistic ploy by the petroleum companies, because the company that basically, the information about peak oil now comes from a company called HIS Energy Services Incorporated. It is a petroleum consulting subsidiary and a wholly owned one at that of Thyssen-Bornemisza Enterprises, the same Thyssen industrial complex or nexus that one of whose members, Thyssen Krupp, purchased the old Leuna IG Farben synthetic oil refinery in the former East Germany. And now we have a Thyssen subsidiary dependent on data given it by the very petroleum industry and petroleum geological firms that stand to benefit from increased oil prices, saying, yep, oil production is peaking, basically. Not that we're necessarily running out of oil, but that it's the production is declining. Prices must stay high. And the problem is, first of all, that the only people with expertise in that regard are the very interests that stand to profit. How many people know what about petroleum geology? And so it's a wonderful feedback loop. And we have Thyssen Krupp purchasing the old Leuna facility and thereby in a position to begin profiting from the old Standard IG Agreement of 1929. The Rockefellers themselves now own 38% of the Thyssen stock. One of the Thyssen's major business partners in the pre-World War II and World War II periods were the Bush family, specifically George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather of the current president, respectively. For the Record 260 and 261, I spoke, among other things, those programs are called Economics 911. I spoke about one of the most profound political and economic phenomena in the world today, one that has made, among other things, the $50-plus price per barrel of oil a more or less permanent fixture, and that in turn has made the realization of the Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process developed by IG Farben, that can now become profitable and therefore has been resuscitated. One of the things to bear in mind about the high oil prices is the fact that war in the Middle East generates it. The more violence there is there, never mind exactly who's doing whom, whether it's the Israelis doing the Arabs or the Arabs doing the Israelis or Arabs doing Arabs or Iranians doing Israelis or Iranians doing Arabs or whatever, pay attention to the violence, pay attention to the warfare, pay attention also not just to the violence itself, but to the threats of violence, and ignore for the time being the players themselves, and pay attention to the violence itself, because what it does is drive up the price of oil, and that increase in the price of oil, in addition to realizing the Standard IG agreement, cartel agreement, the Standard IG Farben cartel agreement, it has also launched. It is the precipitating factor in a vast worldwide transfer of capital. Everything and everyone on the face of the earth, for all intents and purposes, uses oil directly or indirectly. And when the price goes of oil goes up, the price of everything goes up. And it basically is affecting a vast transfer of wealth from everything and everybody into the pockets of some of the most foul interests that have ever walked the face of the earth, not just the oil companies themselves. And by the way, you want to study fascism, you study the politics of oil, because, boy, the petroleum companies were deeply involved with it. But you also, when you talk about the elements producing oil, some of the most foul regimes on earth benefit from petroleum. We've basically got, for all intents and purposes, an Islamic Nazi running Iran right now. Talking about Saudi Arabia's greatest hits, not too long ago, a woman in Saudi Arabia who had been gang-raped was sentenced to 90 lashes from the religious police because they ruled that she brought it on herself. I've forgotten off the top of my head what it is that she did, showed her ankles in public or something equally apocalyptic. But these are the elements that are, you talk about political reform, there could be a little bit there. These are the elements, however, which not only are not reform, but they are gaining preeminence, not just because of the price of oil, but also the reinvestment of that capital in corporations, in media corporations, in the American and other academic institutions, and it's going to have a huge effect. But so pay attention as we speak here on April 1st of 2007. Pay attention to the violence itself, with war clouds never having left the Middle East, in addition to with the ongoing slaughter in Iraq. The situation vis-a-vis Israel and the Arabs figures to erupt again soon. We've got, for all intents and purposes, an Islamic Nazi, a David Duke fellow traveler, a Holocaust denier, pushing for nuclear power in Iran. And now we have another Iranian hostage crisis. This, of course, has come when some British sailors and Marines were captured by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard naval forces. The British say they were in Iraqi waters. The Iranians say they were in Iranian national waters. There are also reports all over the Internet of a proposed April 6th American attack on Iran. I will say, if in fact that happens, it has to get a low mark for operational security. We will see. But again, pay attention to the violence itself. Pay attention to the war clouds themselves, ignoring for the time being who exactly is doing whom, but pay attention to the economic effects of it, such as reported by the Financial Times of London of March 24th and 25th of 2007, their weekend edition, article by Kevin Morrison about the Iranian hostage crisis, the new one, Hostage Crisis 2. You notice how things are sort of coming in twos in on the Earth Island in the Muslim world, in the areas that not incidentally produce oil. We had the first Iraq War, the first Gulf War, and now the second would be, we had the Iranian-Iraq War, we had the first Gulf War, now the second Gulf War. We had the first Afghan War, now we have a second Afghan War. We had the first Iranian hostage crisis when the U.S. Embassy was seized in 1979 and 52 hostages were taken. Now we've got the second Iranian hostage crisis. Again, Financial Times, 324-325 of 2007, Kevin Morrison's article, Oil Rises After Capture of UK Sailors Increases Tensions. Greater profits for the oil producers, corporate and national, and also yet more foundational pricing for not only continued oil, high oil profits, but also the continued realization or further exploitation of the Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process developed by IG Farben and coming into reality once again. Again, oil rises after capture of UK sailors increases tensions. Oil prices rose yesterday when tensions with Iran escalated after the Islamic Republic's capture of 15 UK Royal Navy sailors. The incident comes at an important moment in the standoff between Iran and the West over its nuclear ambitions. The U.S. has sent a second aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf, and the Iranian Navy has started a week of naval exercises there. Heightened geopolitical tensions combined with a tightening oil market have sent oil prices to new highs for the year. crude and petroleum product inventories in the developed world are declining, and U.S. petrol demand is increasing at a stronger than expected pace ahead of peak summer demand. So as people toss around things like this, bear in mind, take a look at the effect on the economy. And Iran itself stands very much to benefit from a rising price of oil. In fact, something that was looming as something of an obstacle for Iran was the declining price of oil. Well, they took care of that, didn't they? We remains to be seen just what takes place on April 6th. The internet forecast U.S. blitzkrieg on the Iranian nuclear infrastructure. Again, if such a thing happens, if this isn't yet another false alarm, and there have been a number of them, boy, you talk about not maintaining operational security, we will see. On the other hand, it may be psychological warfare. It certainly cannot help but drive up the price of oil. An article about, speaking of violence in the Middle East and war in the Middle East, by the way, the Lebanon war last summer drove up the price of oil. And note, again, the For the Record programs 260 and 261, including some information which I have in the descriptions that I did not have in the original programs, with Arab investors talking about how good it was when there was war in the Middle East. It always works for us. It always benefits us because the price of oil goes up. It gives us more money in our pockets, and we can have more to reinvest. An article which in some ways exemplifies what got me into doing this a long time ago, in the early 70s, when what really piqued my interest in what I now call anti-fascist research, I began looking at the assassination of President Kennedy and other things, and I would save, or I would read articles in the paper, and I would talk about them with people, and people would say, BS, I don't believe that. But when I started actually saving some of the more interesting articles and showing them to them, it convinced them. It carries a different weight when you can source things. And I continue to be shocked by some of the really, really important stories that will make it even into sometimes relatively mainstream sources and yet go completely unignored. And it's almost surreal. In the wake of the Lebanon War of 2006, one of the charges that was kicked around was that it was a disproportionately large Israeli response to the kidnapping of a couple of soldiers. Actually, that particular campaign had been planned for a long time, and in fact, the actual military plan was aborted for reasons I'm going to speculate about in a minute. But I have heard that apparently recently in a commission that's investigating Prime Minister Olmert's of Israel, that is, Prime Minister of Israel Olmert's conduct of the war. And in testimony, he testified that, in fact, preparations for the war had been going on for a long time. The following, maybe there was some place on the internet where this was kicked around, but on Friday, July 21st of last year, I was reading my morning San Francisco Chronicle, and there was a long article at the bottom of the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I misplaced my copy of this and was not able to regain another copy, but people should bear in mind I have to work a day job. I misplaced this article, and it sort of exemplifies why I began doing what I do. There are some really, really interesting and important things that actually get published but never get assimilated or publicized. In fact, the Israeli operation in Lebanon had been planned and journalists had been briefed on it a year before, even more. Article from the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, Israel set war plan more than a year ago. Strategy was put in motion as Hezbollah began gaining military strength in Lebanon. It's by Matthew Kalman of the Chronicle Foreign Service, July 21st of 2006. Israel's military response by air, land, and sea to what it considered a provocation last week by Hezbollah militants is unfolding according to a plan finalized more than a year ago. Parenthetically, nope, that plan got aborted. Talk about that later. In the 6 years since Israel ended its military occupation of southern Lebanon, it watched warily as Hezbollah built up its military presence in the region. When Hezbollah militants kidnapped two Israeli soldiers last week, the Israeli military was ready to react almost instantly. Of all of Israel's wars since 1948, this was the one for which Israel was most prepared, unquote, said Gerald Steinberg, professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University. Again quoting, in a sense, the preparation began in May of 2000, immediately after the Israeli withdrawal, when it became clear the international community was not going to prevent Hezbollah from stockpiling missiles and attacking Israel. By 2004, the military campaign, scheduled to last about 3 weeks that we're seeing now, had already been blocked out, and in the last year or two, it's been simulated and rehearsed across the board. More than a year ago, senior Israeli Army officers began giving PowerPoint presentations and on an off-the-record basis to U.S. and other diplomats, journalists, and think tanks, setting out the plan for the current operation in revealing detail. Under the ground rules of the briefings, the officers could not be identified. Again, this is surreal. I saw no other mention of this fact and, in any of the media at the time. Perhaps it was something I missed or some of my associates who helped me out missed, but surreal. It was on the front page of the bleeping San Francisco Chronicle, Friday, July 21st of 2006, and yet it's as though it never was published at all. That sort of phenomenon is one of the things that got me into this kind of work in the first place. And one of the things I would note is that the plan for the Lebanon invasion last fall was fundamentally aborted. The original plan, which would have worked, not the debacle which unfolded, involved basically the simultaneous implementation of several things. By the way, the Israeli media as well as various strategic publications have talked about this. The original plan called for a number of things simultaneously. An airstrike against the Hezbollah leadership, the whereabouts of which the Israelis knew, in order to basically not only kill some of them, but to keep them busy dodging rounds and not in a position to exercise command and control functions to the maximum extent. So in addition to disrupting command and control with airstrikes on the leadership, simultaneous fast-moving armored columns were to move up on both flanks involving mechanized infantry and heavy armor, and at the same time, parachute elements were to be dropped along the Litani River to cut off the possibility of resupply and reinforcement. Now that is the way you attack a fixed frontward-facing fortification, something like what Hezbollah had in northern Lebanon with the aid of Iranian and other engineers. In fact, what Hezbollah had there was not only some very sophisticated Russian-built anti-tank missiles, but something along the lines of a Maginot Line, a formidable ground-based dug-in line of defense that was virtually, if not impregnable, certainly very formidable to a frontal assault. Well, when you're going to attack a position like that, you don't roll right up with tanks, which is exactly what it's meant to repel. What you do is you do what the Israelis would originally have done, the original plan, again, whacking the Hezbollah leadership, disrupting command and control, two rapid-moving flanking movements at the same time, combined with a parachute drop in the rear. That's how you attack. That's a good military plan, and that's how you attack something like that. You don't roll up to the, you know, in World War II, the German panzer divisions didn't roll up to the front of the Maginot Line and go, okay, let's go. It doesn't work that way. But what happened was it was aborted. I've seen several overlapping explanations in the Israeli and strategic media. One, the most disturbing in some ways I will talk about in a minute. One of them said that, first of all, the Israeli chief of staff at the time, since resigned, General Don Halutz, was an Air Force general, a so-called blue general, and that he had an over-reliance on air power, so he scrubbed the original plan in favor of an air assault. The second sort of supplemental account in the media talked about Olmert's background. He's a tort lawyer, and it said that he approached this military campaign by simply going with an aerial campaign, rather like a tort lawyer who files a lawsuit and then sort of waits for the enemy to settle, that he really did not understand military affairs. In that same context, the Israeli defense minister at the moment, a guy named Amir Peretz, is incompetent. There was a very fairly well-distributed piece of footage. He was watching Israel Defense Forces maneuvers, and he was holding up a pair of field glasses. They still had the lens caps on, and he was going nodding and watching these maneuvers, and all of the staffers behind him were laughing because he forgot to take off the lens caps. He's incompetent. So incompetence may have played a role. Perhaps the most disturbing thing was that the U.S. actually, one of the Israeli media accounts said that the U.S., the Bush administration, specifically cautioned the Israelis against their actualizing their real plan, and that it was the Bush administration which precipitated the change of Israeli strategic doctrine. One of the things to note in that regard was that the National Security Agency was engaging in signals intelligence collection during the Lebanon War, because the Hezbollah forces are not only Iranian trained and having Iranian liaison officers, they speak Farsi. And so the NSA was gathering signals intelligence during the Iranian during the Lebanon War of 2006, in particular vis-a-vis anti-air operations or potential measures. One wonders if perhaps, if in fact that one account that the U.S. Prevailed on the Israeli administration to change the plan of attack, so to speak, one wonders if that was accurate, and if so, whether it was in anticipation of some sort of operation in Iran. We will see. Before leaving the subject of Lebanon War, do check out some of the internet links on For the Record 564 and others documenting the monumental falsification of war news in that war. Last item. The second item in the tonight's program, or this today's program. This program was from a column in the Jerusalem Post about George Soros' wartime activities. A very, very interesting point of information indeed comes from that very same Carolyn Glick column. Column 1, The Road to Serfdom. People who value political and journalistic freedom should take note of the following. In this column from March 22nd of 2007, last month, two students at Cambridge University's Clare College became victims of this state of affairs, meaning the stifling of freedom of expression. The students dedicated an edition of their satire magazine, again at Cambridge University's Clare College, to the one-year anniversary of the global Muslim riots which followed the publication of caricatures of Muhammad in the Danish Jyllands-Posten newspaper. As the students recall, those riots led to the deaths of more than 100 people. Although the British media refused to republish these caricatures, British Muslims held terrifying protests throughout the country where they called for the destruction of Britain, the U.S., Denmark, and Israel for the murder of all who refused to accept the global domination of Islam. In their magazine, the students published some of the caricatures and mocked the Muslims for their hypocrisy in accusing British society of racial prejudice while calling for its violent destruction. The Muslim reaction was apparently swift. Fearing for their lives, the students were forced into hiding. But the Muslims were not alone in their anger. Clare College set up a special disciplinary court to consider action against the students. And the Cambridgeshire Police opened a criminal investigation against them in late February. Shocking behavior on the part of the British authorities and the authorities at Cambridge University. Political correctness can definitely go a little too far. Britain is one of the countries, by the way, which in its fevered quest for reinvested oil wealth has virtually reduced itself to dimitude. Some of the more reactionary elements of the Muslim community view of Christians and Jews as lesser people of the book, although not worthy of extermination like an infidel. They are lesser creatures and to be treated as such. And sadly, some countries, such as, to a certain extent at least, the United Kingdom, in their quest to grab hold of that reinvested oil wealth, have virtually reduced themselves to dimitude. And again, as I said in the program about Cartoongate, as I call it, you know, people in Muslim countries don't want to portray the Prophet Muhammad, fine, that's part of their religion. But imposing that on other countries and other cultures, that is a different story. And people should not underestimate the significance of that shocking behavior on the part of the British civil and Cambridge University authorities. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program, number 591. I've alluded to many other programs and other pieces of information. Check the Spitfire website and the linked websites for the vast amount of information that is available on those websites. And also, there is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what's going on, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. My name's Dave Emery. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 591, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on April 1st of 2007. Thanks for listening.